Welcome to History 605, South Dakota State Historical Society's podcast, where we talk to historians, curators, filmmakers, artists, and authors about how they interpret the past.
10,000 years from now, I think we can meditate and wonder whether our descendants, because I think they'll still be here, what they will think about us. And let us hope that at least they will give us the benefit of the doubt.
I'm Dr. Ben Jones, South Dakota State Historian and Director of the State Historical Society. Join me and our guests as we think historically.
So it is most appropriate and fitting that in our first year of our second century that this should also be a year of reconciliation between the Indian people and the non-Indian people alike.
History 605 is sponsored by the Gruver Family Trust and done in partnership with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Welcome to the show.
Welcome to History 605. Today on the show, I'm very excited to welcome as guests Marcus Witcher and David Beto. David is an emeritus professor of history at the University of Alabama and a senior research fellow at the Independent Institute. He holds a PhD from the University of Wisconsin, and his academic research has covered a wide variety of topics in American history, but particularly things regarding civil rights, tax revolts, civil liberties, and non-governmental provision of infrastructure and mutual aid. His most recent book is a book on the New Deal, and I've just found out he's got a new book on FDR coming out this fall. David, welcome to History 605.
Thank you for inviting me.
And joining us is his co-editor on this book that we'll be talking about, Marcus Witcher. Marcus is a teaching assistant professor of economic history at West Virginia University, where he also serves as the manager of the undergraduate programs for the NEE Regulatory Research Center. He completed his doctorate in history from the University of Alabama in 2017. His first book, Getting Right with Reagan, The Struggle for True Conservatism, 1980 to 2016, was published by the University Press of Kansas. He is also the co-editor of various collections and written essays for a wide variety of publications. I've invited them on the show to talk about a recent book they've published with the South Dakota Historical Society Press entitled Rose Lane Says, which is her thoughts on race, liberty, and equality, 1942 to 1945. Marcus, welcome to History 605.
Thanks so much for having me.
Rose Lane is famously the daughter of the far more famous Laura Ingalls Wilder. And Rose was born in South Dakota. And so when the opportunity to publish this with the South Dakota Historical Society kind of came together, this was an exciting thing for us to kind of highlight the political thought of a political theorist and a leader in 20th century libertarian thought, Rose Lane. I'm wondering how the two of you came across Rose Lane's work, and I'll throw it to David first. What first interested you in Rose Lane and her political philosophy?
Well, I've been aware of sort of different strains of libertarian thought for forever, right? Since I was a teenager, and I've known about Lane. I never really seriously studied her, however, but she was always a presence. I was aware of her. I had respect for her. I knew her importance. However, I really never looked that deeply into her, into what she did, until I came across I was reading a biography of Rose Wilder Lane. I forget who wrote this. Maybe Marcus can remember. And I didn't want to trash the biography. It was an okay biography. It was called Little Ghost on the Prairie, I think, something like that. Quite a while ago. And he has the author of that has a paragraph where he mentions, just as kind of an aside, that she wrote for this black newspaper, you know, called the Pittsburgh Courier, and kind of gave the impression that this was like she's looking for work and wrote for this paper in this kind of marginal situation. Well, I got curious about this, and at the Herbert Hoover Library in Iowa, which has Rose's papers, they had all of these, or they had many of them anyway, of these op-eds that she wrote for a two-year period. From 1943, 3-year period, 1942 to 45, I said, these look really interesting. I've written a lot about civil rights history. And so it became clear to me that this is not an obscure paper. The Pittsburgh Courier was perhaps the best, the most widely circulated black paper, a couple hundred thousand subscribers, distributed throughout the country, and highly respected paper. So she was writing for a paper that had a lot of subscribers, and she actually had a far more subscribers to that paper than people that ever bought her main book, Discovery of Freedom, the book that we often cite as her signature work, or one of them anyway, you know, sold during her lifetime, I don't know, a couple thousand copies. Every week, her op-eds were reaching over 200,000 people. So Marcus was my student at the University of Alabama, the best student I'd had. We worked together on various projects. And so it just sort of came like a kind of a, it came together, like this made sense. And we got together on the project. It was a lot of fun. We had to get these op-eds, and it was a challenge because a lot of them were very hard to read, blurred out. Their originals don't survive. So we had to use microfilm. We had to use other copies to supplement it. And we were able to reconstruct almost all of them. I think there were some that we were not able to use, but just because so much of it was missing and illegible. But yeah, we were able to put it all together. But it was a lot of fun. It was a real challenge. We sat in a restaurant together. We read it to each other just so we got it right. And felt like a biblical, you know, New Testament apostles trying to get it right, right? You know, like, did he really say this? You know, yeah. So that was enjoyable part right. of the work, but it was tedious too.
David was my advisor, my graduate school advisor at the University of Alabama, him and Dr. Carrie Fredrickson, and he was a great advisor, and he had mentioned this project that he'd always wanted to do. And so after David retired, or became emeritus, you know, he had the time to finally dedicate to it. And I had just finished up a book titled Black Liberations in the Marketplace. And so I was, you know, available as well. And so we took the time while I was still teaching at Huntington College in Alabama to actually meet up, like David said, at a coffee shop. And I'll never forget David sitting there with a magnifying glass with the microfilm, you know, pieces printed out, and I'm just looking around and people are just staring at us, and I'm like, historians here, right? Don't stare. I became acquainted with, you know, Rose Wilder Lane really through the work of Ayn Rand. I learned a great deal about Ayn Rand as like many other sort of young libertarians. Was infatuated with Rand in my youth, have since grown up and matured in my ethical understandings, you know, much more sort of Scottish Enlightenment today than back then. But I was always a fiscal conservative, social moderate to liberal, and so I, you know, gravitated towards these ideas. And Ayn Rand, Isabel Patterson, and Rose Wilder Lane are always sort of spoken of as the three furies of libertarianism. I think they were given that name by William F. Buckley, the founder of National Review. And so I was aware of Lane. I knew that she was one of the founding mothers of libertarianism. She famously sort of coined, I guess, that phrase or that word, sort of libertarian. So I was aware of her. And so when David was talking to me, you know, when I was still a graduate student about this idea he'd had for years, I kind of filed it away because I didn't have the time while I was working on my dissertation. But once we had a little bit of free time, I think I reached out to David and said, hey, we should really do this. Because this would be a cool project for the two of us to work on together. We publish articles, but this would be a cool project to come together on, work on, and ultimately see through to publication.
She has an interesting career arc, though. I mean, I think she left South Dakota when she was a toddler, grew up, must have been in Missouri. Then she gets into where did she go to college? Never went to college. That's interesting.
Graduated high school in, she was in Missouri, and I think she graduated because she had a relative that high school was, I think, in Louisiana. She had a relative there. Okay. So she did do that, but she's a self-taught person and, you know, always a reader. Great right. example. Somebody was reading from, I don't know, age five or younger, but very much self-taught. Yeah.
We've published some things about her in our quarterly journal before. A couple of years ago, there was an article about her time in Europe as a young woman covering the events in Turkey and so forth just after the First World War. She's in Paris briefly, and it's kind of, well, it's very interesting to think that she's kind of a part of this crowd, jet-setting crowd of young Americans like Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald that's hanging around Paris coffee shops and then going doing things in post-World War Europe. She's certainly as adventurous as Hemingway is, but she goes down this lane to helping her mom in the late 30s and 40s and 50s with editing her works and so forth, but doing all these newspaper articles. How does she get hired by the Pittsburgh Courier and a black newspaper? It must have been an interesting chain of events that brings that about.
Yeah, so I'll just say before David jumps in, Jabe, maybe you can recount how she came to be acquainted with the Courier itself, that, yeah, Lane was in Europe. She was exploring ideas. She'd flirted with socialism sort of in the 19-teens and 20s. There's a story which may or may not be fully true or may exaggerate a little bit, that she actually came close to joining the Communist Party before traveling to Europe. It was actually her time in Europe seeing sort of, you know, authoritarian socialism in practice that she said, whoa, this actually doesn't work very well. And her time abroad, you know, it had a profound effect upon her in terms of the way that she viewed Islam. Her time over in Eastern Europe changed the way that she viewed that. She'd be a lifelong sort of admirer of Islam. And really led her to believe that all people are essentially equal. The difference is sort of the institutional arrangements, right? Whether or not there's private property, whether or not it's secured, whether or not you have individual liberties. That those are the things that ultimately have led the United States to prosperity, and that if only the people in Eastern Europe had had access to those types of institutional arrangements, they too would have been prosperous. And over time, she sort of gradually moves away from those sort of collectivist views towards a more individualistic perspective.
Well, that's interesting. She certainly is a curious person and evidently able to take in new evidence and change her mind. That's kind of refreshing.
Yeah, just sort of continue that and your question about how she ended up at the Courier's. But just say a little bit more about this. She knew everybody, and she knew all, you know, many of the most familiar intellectual figures of the 19-teens and 1920s, 1930s. John Reed, was a communist figure, very important intellectual. She knew him, and he may have almost roped her in to get in the communist movement. And she knew Sinclair Lewis, very good friends with him, was well acquainted with the sort of leading intellectuals of the period, was respected by them, was sort of part of that whole group, right? How did she end up with the Courier? Well, she had someone who did work for her, work in her house, I guess it was, that someone she hired, a black woman, and this woman was a reader of, and Lane was a very, I don't know how this exactly happened, but Lane is a very curious, inquisitive person, right? Asked a lot of questions, her journalistic training, and found out what this woman read and started to read it herself. It was the Pittsburgh Courier, and became a fan of the Pittsburgh Courier, which at the time had launched, this is World War II, beginning of World War II, had launched a campaign called the Double V campaign. And yes. This was, unlike in World War I, the African-Americans associated with the Courier said, we're not going to be fooled again. People like Du Bois went along with the war, hoping that this will prove themselves and this would lead to something. And they said, no, we'll support the war. However, we're making it clear that this is a war for liberty, and it's a war for liberty at home. And they called it the Double V campaign. And she liked that a lot. And wow. She wrote a fan letter, and one of the top people there named Joel Rogers, kind of a well-known figure in popularizer of black history, well-known guy. He liked, this, and he recommended her. And she ended up becoming, she didn't seek this out, but she ended up becoming an op-ed, wrote a weekly op-ed for the Courier. And they had a kind of interesting system. It was a weekly paper, so she wrote in every issue, where they would have a lot of op-ed writers that were intellectually diverse, but also diverse in other ways. Like they had the Japanese semanticist Hayakawa, later became a U.S. senator. They had someone from India. They had somebody from, you know, they had white people, right? They had African-Americans. And so she just fit right in. And she would engage in debates kind of gently with her fellow columnists. And so you had these running debates and things like that that were a lot of fun because she liked to mix it up. And she was also just a team player on the Courier. She always said, look, you want, you know, readers, please send me your work. I'll look at it, right? I'll critique it. She went to the functions of the Courier. So she really, it wasn't just that she was earning some money on the side. She really embraced the experience.
And where was she living when she was doing this writing? She
was living in, I guess it was Danbury, right? So she would, you know, come in there occasionally, right? But she would, you know, send her pieces in. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and her greatest ally at the Courier was probably George Schuyler, right? The sort of libertarian conservative black commentator who during the 1930s became really critical of FDR's New Deal and was pretty hard-hitting towards the Roosevelt administration on Japanese internment, right? Condemning Japanese internment and basically saying, hey, look, you know, black Americans should care about this too, because if the government can do these things to black Americans, it can also do it, to Japanese Americans, it can also, right, do it to us and to any other group of people. And so her and Schuyler, I think, formed a pretty special bond. She even is writing to Schuyler's wife, Josephine, 20 years later about an unpublished manuscript, right? So they developed, I think, a friendship and some solidarity in the face of the other columnists who were more progressive or liberal.
So were there columnists that were, say, out-and-out supporters of the New Deal that were in the Courier?
Yeah, definitely were. Okay. It was intellectually divorced. A lot of them were. Now, the publisher of the Courier is kind of an interesting figure. If you read American history, you see him quoted a lot. Where in 1932, he said, we paid our debt to Lincoln. It is time for us to turn the picture of Lincoln to the facing the wall and support Roosevelt. Very often cited. What is often not mentioned is Van. He later kind of loses faith in Roosevelt and to some extent the New Deal, and he ends up going back and supporting the Republican Party in subsequent elections. But he's kind of a respected figure. He's not identified with any one political philosophy. So you have a lot of people that are very high up in the paper, probably dominant, who are more sympathetic to the New Deal, and she clashes with them.
Okay. Well, let's walk through. So the book then consists of her op-eds, essentially, right? And you've got each chapter is an op-ed. So, you know, you can kind of dive in, pick and choose. It's not necessarily a book you would read, you know, straight through cover to cover, but there's 84 chapters, and you set up what's gone on there in an introduction, and there's a foreword that kind of set the scene, but it talks about a wide variety of things, largely focused on notions of freedom, on capitalism. It's an interesting chapter. Well, there's four or five times she talks about tariffs, which is something in the news today. A lot of things, and she tends to come back, well, frequently in her columns is this, she uses the word energy, or individual energy. And that struck me at some point. It's almost like a religious notion to her that it has this, I don't want to make light of it, but it's like the Force from Star Wars or something. There's this action agency each individual has, and she certainly seems to point out at every opportunity that is a moral thing that must be upheld. And of course, she quotes Paine and a lot of the founders to kind of make those arguments. So then you, I think it was Marcus, mentioned that she, the term libertarianism comes from her. Is that, did I understand that correctly?
Yeah, there are at least some people who claim that she was the one who sort of coined the term. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, if I could just interrupt you real quickly, Marcus.
Sure.
I think it was a term that was used, but it was used a lot by anarchist left wingers, and they would use it. And she said this is a great term and, you know, popularized it certainly, the libertarian movement, to refer to, you know, her perspective. I'm sorry, Marcus. Go ahead.
No, that's great, David. Yeah, that's absolutely true. There are people in the 19th century who would use the term libertarian, but as far as being applied to sort of the individualistic sort of movement that we think of it as today, and especially like the LP, right, and the things that they stand for, that's what we're referring to in the introduction when we say that she, quote unquote, sort of reframed or coined it in this new way, and it gave birth or contributed to giving birth to, the libertarian movement and the Libertarian Party.
You mentioned Ayn Rand, that I had just kind of assumed that she was the one that coined that, but she was just one of the three Furies, as you mentioned earlier.
And Rand actually hated libertarians because she thought they were sellouts. She thought they were too pragmatic. She didn't think they were principled enough, and they weren't objectivists, which means they didn't, prescribe to the correct ethical philosophy, according to her. And without the correct ethical philosophy, you would inevitably simply, divulge into collectivism again. So Rand, being true to her own sort of contrarian, individualistic, objectivist self, did not like the term libertarian, and did not like all these libertarians who seemed to like her work. I'm sure she enjoyed the profits from them reading her work, but she didn't seem to like them very much.
Right-wing hippies. That's what she described libertarians as.
Wow. Okay.
And that was not meant as a compliment.
Well, it doesn't sound like one. Well, let's get into it. I wonder if there's some columns that you want to point out, or if there's a few things that you thought were particularly fun to piece together, and or that you were shocked or surprised to see. And again, the setting of these columns is in the midst of the Second World War. So there's a great deal. You mentioned the Double V campaign. There's each war needs a reason to win. I don't care what war you're talking about. Particularly a war is fought by democracies. They need a popular conception of what the war's about and the desire to win it. And FDR's conception of what the war is about clearly is, in late 42 at the Casablanca Conference, where he announces unconditional surrender as the aim of the war. That, I don't know that most people, when they hear about that, recognize the moral implications of what that would mean for the United States. The unconditional surrender, particularly of the regimes like Germany and Japan, not to discount Italy, but the fact that the United States would go to great lengths to make sure their utter destruction, and that the peace treaty says what we dictate it says. That's a moral choice. Given that framework, what would Rose Lane say about unconditional war and FDR's moral choice for that?
I don't know if she really addressed that, to be honest with you.
Isn't that interesting?
Okay. In these essays. Now, there were people that thought that was overly rigid. Eisenhower was one of them. He thought unconditional surrender. Stalin even thought that. He thought that was overly rigid. It may have done some damage in Italy, because FDR kind of, after Mussolini was overthrown, he was sort of like of the opinion, so what, these fascists overthrew Mussolini, they're still fascists, we don't really want to deal with them. And in the meantime, Germany poured troops into the peninsula and made that fight much harder. So, and of course, one could argue about Japan and the atomic bomb. But anyway, she didn't, to be fair to Lane, she really didn't. I didn't. Marcus, do you recall her even getting into that debate? There's certain things she just doesn't get into, which is kind of interesting in and of itself. Okay. She's more interested in, she's very interested in race.
Yeah.
Very innovative stuff. She's trying to get a dialogue with African-Americans. She's pushing a kind of individualist perspective but not a kind of holier than thou perspective. But so Marcus, Lane, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no worries. Yeah. So I think Lane, she does speak about World War II, and she was a part of what we might call the old right, which were, you know, a group of intellectuals and politicians who were generally free markets, but generally more non-interventionist when it came to foreign policy. And Lane was definitely part of that sort of, she thought along those lines, right? She didn't really want to get involved in World War II. She thought it would lead to civil rights infringements, just like World War I had led to civil rights infringements, right? You know, anytime you go to war, government sort of expands, and then there are violations of civil liberties. And so she thought that war was, I think she thought war was the antithesis of liberty, right? Like, you know, you got to have a big government, which then will wage this war, which will squash individual liberty. So I think to a certain extent, she was skeptical of World War II and U.S. involvement. And of course, she was skeptical of FDR. After Pearl Harbor, she becomes much more supportive of the war effort, at least in the sense that she wants to see the United States win over Nazi Germany, right? But Rose Lane believed that it was inevitable that the United States would win World War II. How could it not? How could free enterprise not squash, you know, autarky in Nazi Germany? You know, they are not trading with anybody. They don't have free enterprise. They're not unleashing the energy of their citizenry. How could the United States not win? And so she believed that the United States and American capitalism would succeed, but it would be in spite of FDR, New Deal,
good,
and the technocrats, right, and the bureaucracy.
Yeah.
She thought they were the only thing that could possibly stop us from squashing collectivist authoritarianism in Europe. And so I don't know that she really talked a whole lot about unconditional surrender. And as David says, she kind of doesn't speak a great deal about some things that I think we wish she would have, like Japanese internment. She mentions it sort of just once, you know. Mm-hmm. She talks about the very, like, I think it's something along the lines of the unfortunate situation of the Japanese in California, right? Which she seems to allude to was a violation of their civil liberties, but didn't get into at great length, unlike George Schuyler, her colleague at the Courier. And so I think that would have been Lane's sort of position on World War II, that, you know, we want to win. Obviously, you know, Western liberal, you know, market liberalism is superior to these authoritarian forces, but we don't want to become the enemy, so to speak, right? With the growth of government in the process of defeating the enemy.
So, yeah, that's an ancient statement. Is it Socrates? I think if you when fighting an enemy, you have to become like them in order to defeat them. I think that sounds Aristotle or Socrates, I think, is the one who coined that phrase, and she may be riffing off of that, which is very true, that nations or combatant nations do that. They become like the enemy they're seeking to defeat. And so it seems like she then has the war aim of letting liberty actually shine through post-war.
Yeah, and during the war, she actually, it's interesting, you know, David recounts this very well, you know, in the part of the introduction about how Lane resisted, in certain ways, World War II and the security apparatus that emerged. David, do you want to speak to that?
Yeah, certainly before the war, Lane was testified before Congress for a constitutional amendment to limit the president's war power, which was supported, you know, so she was somebody that was, I guess you could say, somebody that was an anti-war figure before the war, very suspicious, very anti-communist. Once Pearl Harbor happens, she says, oh, we got to win this. We're going to win this because of freedom, you know, because free societies are superior. And Marcus, you were asking me something about that. I missed the question. What was it related to this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, during World War II, she actually ends up running afoul of the FBI and administration.
Yeah, she's, you know, she's not an unquestioning backer of the war. And she's willing to, oppose certain things. Like, for example, Social Security. She objected to Social Security taking part of her wages, and she earned some money from the Courier. So she lowered her income purposely. So she grew her own food. She canned her own food and so forth. So her income was so low, she didn't have to pay. She didn't have to pay Social Security. She was also and this got a lot of publicity, and it was sort of like a very interesting kind of protest during the war, at the height of the war. Also at the height of the war, she said, and again, this is tied in with her argument. She wrote to this guy who was this New Dealer who was talking about public education. We got to, when we go in the war, post-war, we got to go into Germany and teach them about public education, the virtue. And she wrote him back, said, well, public education, Germany was a pioneer in Bismarck, centralized state schooling. Look what that did. And some guy from the post office in Connecticut saw this. It was a card she sent. And he complained to the authorities, and it ended up with the FBI, and they investigated. Lane kind of told them, this is my free speech rights and you get off my property. And there was a lot of support for free speech during the war, not because of Roosevelt. A lot of people, he didn't necessarily like it, but there was Americans were more dedicated than in World War at the popular level than in World War I to free speech. So she had a lot of people who said, well, why are they bothering this woman? Including the FBI director ultimately said, although publicly he kind of defended the Bureau, privately said, why are we, we need to cut personnel if we're sending them out to investigate things like this. So, he would never say that publicly, but he said it privately.
So J. Edgar Hoover basically told his guys to back off. We need to focus on bank robbers and stuff.
Yeah, it's like, why are you doing this?
Well, that's just bizarre. So a postal worker rats her out, I guess, to use the colloquial phrase, and the FBI knocks on her door.
First it was the state police, and they got the FBI in it, and it just just mushroomed, and it became a big story for several weeks.
That would prove her point, right? Yeah. I mean, if the FBI and the state police are so big, they can knock on my door based on some, just a postcard worth of activity that demonstrates her point beautifully, better than a column ever could.
Yeah, and of course the argument was, well, we're investigating to see if this is, subversive. She said, well, if you think that's subversive, I'm subversive as hell. She just had this really dramatic kind of, like, he owned it, and it was like she ran with it and went to the American Civil Liberties Union, and they backed her up.
Oh,
she
got
backing from a lot of people you would not normally, it's a very different world. Much more civil libertarianism was there were people, a lot of people that were willing to defend civil liberties across the board, maybe more so than today.
Right.
I would say, sadly.
Are there columns you'd like to kind of point out then, or were there certain tiffs going on within the paper, or maybe she's broaching certain subjects?
Yeah, I mean, I think that especially given the current administration and the debates over tariffs, going back and rereading those four or five columns about tariffs is really impressive. I mean, Rose Lane is anticipating so many of the arguments that so many of my economist colleagues are using now to sort of refute the arguments of the Trump administration on the merits of protectionism, right? She talks about, she sort of anticipates what's known as the public choice school of economics, which is a school of economics that says you have to actually look at politicians are self-interested, and you can't compare sort of the ideal solution to the market solution. You have to compare the actual political solution to the market solution to determine what is the best, what should we do? Should government regulate this, or should we leave it up to maybe the flawed, but nonetheless the imperfect free market, right, to carry it out? And she anticipates this type of criticism by pointing out that protectionism is simply going to lead to cronyism and rent seeking and a variety of different industries lobbying the administration for, special privileges and protections and opt-outs. And we're already seeing that. We saw that with the first Trump tariffs. We're seeing it with the second series of Trump tariffs. And so I think that those columns can speak to our current moment in a way that you wouldn't think that, a woman with a high school education, right, writing in the 1940s would be able to do. So I think those columns are really interesting. And then I'm always blown away, like, by the very first column in the book, the column on the Double V campaign, and how she writes in and talks about, hey, you know, she's fascinated by the fight for civil liberty that Black Americans have been undergoing for, you know, 50 years at this point. And she applauds them and says, listen, you know, this is the in the tradition of the founding, and I'm ashamed that I didn't recognize this earlier and join this fight earlier. And so she says, how can a recruit, right, speak to people who have been fighting, have been in the trenches, fighting for Black American civil liberties for so many years? And she says, well, nonetheless, you know, I'm going to try to do my best to bring this unique libertarian perspective, right, to this audience and to join this fight for racial equality, which she tied directly to the founders, right?
Yes.
The sort of violation of individual rights, et cetera. So I always find that column to be particularly profound.
Yeah, just to quote a couple of paragraphs down in that column, she says, in the Courier, I discovered the Double V campaign. It means that my country is alive. Here is a living force, consciously carrying on the struggle for human rights. Here, at least, is a place where I belong. Here are Americans who know the meaning of equality and freedom. Wow. She recognizes that and goes on about that. And so this is really a poke in the eye to the Jim Crow laws and all this other kind of stuff that the Black Americans are facing. Is that the case?
Yeah. And I
Promotes what she calls a laissez-faire world. She's going at, you know, African Americans said, hey, think about laissez-faire. You should use that term. You know, and Marcus talks about tariffs. She's a big fan of Bastiat, who the great classical liberal crusader for free trade and for spontaneous order theory, pioneer in that. She's quoting him a lot. But on African Americans, she's not only sort of coming, hey, you know, I support you too. She's offering an affirmative agenda. Like, for example, she compares, kind of anticipates the sit-in movement in a way. Interesting way of doing it. She said, well, why don't you, you know, maybe more people should do like we used to do when women couldn't smoke, right? We'd light up and then they'd come in and tell us to leave and we'd just take our time and, you know, we would eventually leave. You know, sort of like anticipating kind of civil disobedience. She makes some interesting comparisons that later historians made that are pretty radical. She compares slavery to living in a concentration camp. Very hard-hitting. But at the same time, she's pro-freedom. So she says, well, when slavery ended, that's what people needed. And a lot of historians have picked up on that argument as well, how African Americans made tremendous use of what little they had once slavery ended, showed all kinds of innovation and economic growth and creativity. And she really highlights that. But again, you find later historians, Genovese would maybe be an example, who make this argument. Now, you know, it's kind of like the politically correct argument to make in a way now, right? Because she's not portraying African Americans as helpless objects, right? They're fighting back. They're human beings. They're showing creativity.
Yeah. And to just sort of add to that, if I can, Ben, she's ahead of her time on so many different issues, right? I spoke about how on tariffs, her critiques anticipate, you know, a school of economic thought that's still 20 years away from sort of being formalized. Others have begun to make these criticisms. F.A. Hayek, von Mises had made some of these types of criticisms, but the public choice school is still 20 years away. Likewise, she has a very, very sort of poignant critique of race, right? She believes, to use modern parlance, she believes that race is socially constructed. It's not real. It's something that we invented. It's an imaginary construct. And as such, we could simply get rid of the idea of race. She's very cautious. She says, listen, I understand that people who are of a certain color have a certain experience. And so like that experience is going to be really important to them and formative and who they are. We don't want to erase that.
Right.
But the idea of race itself as being a measure by which we can judge people is absurd, Lane would say. And in that, she actually is anticipating modern work that's being done, right? The Field Sisters in 2014 wrote the book Racecraft, and in 2020 or so, I think 2022, right? Sheena Mason wrote a book called The Theory of Racelessness. This is new cutting edge sort of research being done to say, listen, you know, race, there's nothing intrinsically or natural about race. This is a construct. And Lane saying this in 1942, 1943, 1944, anticipating sort of arguments, right, that we see at the forefront of the debates today on these types of questions.
One of the columns mentions something very mockingly. She says, just a trace of melanin and you're put into a certain category or something. It's just,
you know, she is a lot. There is another figure who was also marginalized for her political views, and that's the African-American author Zora Neale Hurston, who had very, very similar views about the absurdity of race. But again, Hurston was somebody who recognized all this creativity and that was going on, all of the distinct aspects of quote African American culture. But the actual idea of race, she thought, was absurd. She was an individualist. And so if you read Hurston, some of the things she wrote at the time, it's like, did Lane write this or Hurston? I mean, if we could do a test on that, it would be very interesting to do, because you would find, I think, remarkable parallels.
Did they know each other?
Argument. You know, that's an interesting question. We tried to find out. Isabel Patterson knew Hurston, and Isabel Patterson was a good friend of Lane. Did she actually know Hurston? I haven't seen any evidence, but if they had met, she knew Schuyler. Schuyler was a good friend, and Schuyler knew Rand, but if and knew Hurston. But if they had met, I think they would have just hit it off. They were two women that I think had a lot in common and would have really, that would have been a quite an interesting meeting to observe, I think.
Well, you talk about how she's kind of preceding a lot of schools of thought about various things. Are there references to her work that come along later after 1945, or what's the impact of these, op-eds? I guess that's the bottom line, is do they kind of go in the dustbin, or are they read and other people agree or disagree or use them to go on to further thinking?
My sense is that following her time at the Courier, they largely disappear. That, you know, the sort of libertarians are aware of them. I would go to conferences. I'm thinking in the 2010s, right? And like, people would talk about, like, every once in a while, I'd be like, oh, you're studying with David Beto. And I'm like, yeah, and we've thought about doing this thing about Rose Lane and her time writing for this black paper, the Pittsburgh Courier. And people would be like, I'm vaguely familiar that something happened there that she might have wrote for them. But I think largely, and David, you can correct me if I'm wrong, I think they were largely lost in terms of like what the content was. And really, people remembered her for the discovery of freedom, right? But so many of those themes are expanded upon in these columns. And so one of the, you know, sort of the merits of the book is that we're bringing all this content that, you know, expands and in some cases precedes the discovery of freedom to readers. Hopefully, you know, Lane's political philosophy can be sort of explored and fleshed out in more detail.
Yeah,
they're lost. They're almost like, and this is our fun for us in a way. And sometimes historians exaggerate. Oh, I've done this and I've done this and we found this. We really did. These columns were forgotten. They were forgotten, I think, by African Americans. Maybe it had an impact, but we didn't see any evidence. And in the libertarian movement, they were kind of forgotten. And Lane had a bitter experience. She was fired. And so she did write a fan letter to the Courier a couple of years after she was fired, or praising an article in there. But I think she kind of just moved on to other things. Not that her views had changed, but she wrote Discovery of Freedom. And in many ways, as Marcus said, Discovery of Freedom was being written during this time. Yeah. These articles anticipate it, but take it in some of the arguments in interesting directions that she doesn't do in the book itself. But okay. This would be very familiar. It was 1943 was Discovery of Freedom, and that is the height of Lane's work at the Courier during okay. that period.
I also think, Ben, that it's really, really important that these op-eds be rediscovered at this moment in time. I see this as part of a larger project by classical liberals. And let me go ahead and define that term for listeners. Classical liberalism is sort of the intellectual tradition of Adam Smith and John Locke, a belief in individual liberty and constitutions and limited government and free markets or relatively free markets, where individuals have autonomy and there are things that the state cannot infringe upon. If you're sitting at home thinking, well, wow, that sounds a lot like the American founding, that's right. It's the philosophy that undergirded the American founding. And I think for most of our history here in the United States, we've all been liberals in a sense, right? We've all adhered to those tenets. We had conservatives, we had progressives, but we were all liberals. We all agreed to the American project. I'm not sure that's the case anymore, to be perfectly honest with you, on the right or on the left, right? And so one of the things that my co-author, Rachel Ferguson, and I saw ourselves as doing when we published Black Liberations in the Marketplace was trying to push back against the 1619 Project and say, hey, we don't have to jettison our liberal values in order to recognize past injustice. But at the same time, push back against the 1776 Project of the right to say, we cannot simply move on and ignore the injustices of the past. And I very much see the resurrection or the rediscovery of Lane's op-eds as part of that endeavor to try and carve out for Americans, you know, a recognition of past injustice while also acknowledging, right, that our liberal values, our belief in individual liberty, those things didn't fail. It was our failure to live up to those ideals. And Lane very much believed that when she was writing for the Pittsburgh Courier. And so I think for classical liberals, for people who feel lost in our sort of political moment, right, here's a new way of sort of looking at racial issues that empowers people rather than looks at them as sort of like, you know, through a paternalistic lens, which is often the case, I think, with progressive policies. And so I think this book, while it won't sell fantastically well, I think is very, very important insofar as resurrecting these things, because classical liberals have actually been at the forefront of the fight for racial equality since the founding. We can go all the way back to the founding. We can talk about Frederick Douglass. We can talk about Villard. We can talk about an array of other classical liberals who fought for individual liberty and rights for Black Americans, including, say, Booker T. Washington. David has written a book on T.R.M. Howard, right? So, I mean, there's this long tradition, and it offers us, I think, in the United States, a third way to address issues of past injustice while not jettisoning the very things that made America great. And I think Lane fits within that tradition and also is one of the few libertarians in the 40s we can find. I mean, there's Hoyles, Schuyler, to the extent that you can sort of say he's kind of a libertarian conservative, who are really good on issues of race. Hayek didn't talk about civil rights much in the United States, for instance. And so I think it is really important to publish these, to rediscover these, and to plug them into a conversation that I think could actually lead to meaningful discourse in the United States at what I think is a pretty bleak moment.
Yeah. And it's a bleak moment. Her moment was even bleaker. And this is, I think, something we can be inspired by. And I'm kind of inspired by it in a way because, you know, sometimes I'll, and Marcus probably feels the same way. We take up, you know, even within sort of libertarian tradition, we take up causes that are not supported, right? You don't have anybody backing this. Just look at Lane. She's pushing for a laissez-faire world in 1943 when you have government planning, you have central planning, you have wage and price controls, you have, you know, laissez-faire is a pejorative term. If anybody, you go back and read books during the period and you look up laissez-faire, you know, Marcus has probably done this too. It's just like pejorative term to everybody. It's taken for granted. And she's going in there, isn't trimming her sails, and she's pushing for this in this black paper. That's, you know, okay. Now we remember her, right? Yeah. Finally, she's getting some recognition here on this. Unfortunately, she's not around to enjoy it, but still, she's getting some recognition. And so that's a lesson, I think.
Certainly, as a historian, you look for continuities and breaks and change over time. And sometimes if you rediscover person like Rose and what she said in the Courier, and you find that continuity, it's not such a break, and you can connect the dots back to things like 1776 in ways that are revealing and mm-hmm. also pretty interesting. And the fact that they're packaged in this Rose Lane human being and her background and her relationship with her mom and a world famous, internationally famous writer is just kind of heightens the interest. Well, Marcus, David, thanks for coming on the show and talking us through Rose Lane Says. Again, this was published last year. The title is Rose Lane Says, edited by David Beto and Marcus Witcher, available from the South Dakota Historical Society Press. Thanks a lot. Hope to see you around South Dakota someday.
Love to come back.
We'd like to thank Howard and Dorothy Gruver for their passion for history and the support of the South Dakota State Historical Society. It's through gifts such as theirs that we're able to tell South Dakota's history.
When a tornado hits a town, I've never been able to figure out which houses were the Democrats, or the Republicans, or the Libertarians. I never knew who the Norwegians were, the Swedes, or the Czechoslovakians, or the Germans. Of course, everybody wants to point out who the Irish are, but other than that,
History 605 is produced by the South Dakota State Historical Society, and its audio engineer is the amazing Kevin Larson. We'd like to thank our partner, South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and most importantly, we'd like to thank you for listening. Please rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to fine podcasts. We'll be back in a couple weeks with another episode of History 605.